Welcome to Hematologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Bruce Chesson for what is usually a whirlwind update on lymphomas and CLL. And to begin, he chatted about the anti-CD30 antibody-drug conjugate, brentuximab vedotin.
We're in a new era in the treatment of patients with lymphoid malignancies, whether it be Hodgkin's lymphoma, non-Hodgkin's, or chronic lymphocytic leukemia. The time has come when we're starting to move away from traditional chemotherapy and towards more targeted approaches. We've been thinking about this for a long time, but now we start to have the tools with which to do it. And brentuximab vedotin is the poster child for this. This is a drug antibody conjugate in which you take a monoclonal antibody. In this case, it's directed against CD30, which is present on almost all classic Hodgkin's lymphoma, as well as some T-cell lymphomas such as anaplastic large cell lymphoma and some others, and even about 25% of diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. You link this antibody tightly to a poison. In this case, it's called MMAE or auristatin, which kills the cells by binding to tubulin. So what happens is you inject this intravenously, gets taken into the bloodstream, binds to the cancer cells, taken up by the cancer cells, at which point the poison is released, and the cells are killed. How do we know this is what really happens? Well, inferentially, because the antibody itself we've studied in the past and is virtually inactive. You put the poison, and now what you're finding out in patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma who have failed the stem cell transplant as well as initial therapy, we're getting a 76% response rate, including, 30-40% complete remissions, and some of these responses last for years. In anaplastic large cell lymphoma, the response rate is 85% with a substantial number of complete remissions. Again, many of these are durable. So this drug is now on the market. The question is, where do you go with it? It has the indication of what I just mentioned, Hodgkin's lymphoma that's failed the stem cell transplant, anaplastic large cell lymphoma that's relapsed or refractory to initial therapy. What we're trying to do now is to move it more towards the initial approach to patients, moving it up front. The standard therapy for Hodgkin's, as you know, is ABVD. The B in there, the bleomycin, is negligibly active and has substantial toxicity, pulmonary, cutaneous. We'd like to get rid of that. The Velban in there also has substantial toxicity. Eventually, maybe we can even get rid of that. But what we're trying to do is to develop strategies where we're moving brentuximab up front. And in fact, the company that makes it is starting a trial of what I call A squared VD, which is Adriamycin. I'll have to use the word et cetera, because that's the other A, meaning it's brentuximab, velbandacarbazine, versus standard ABVD to see whether you can get at least as good activity. In fact, in a pilot study presented at the ASH meetings in December, the number of patients who became PET negative after this A squared VD therapy, and even in the phase one, was over 90%, which is suggestive that it may be higher than we would expect with ABVD alone. So that is a very, very promising new agent. There are other drug antibody conjugates out there that are being studied. There's one that has a bunch of letters and numbers, DCDT, and followed by some numbers. And we've been doing a phase one with that. It's an anti-CD22, and it has the same linker and the same poison as does brentuximab, but the CD22 is specific for B cells. So these are very exciting drugs, a new class, a new approach of targeting therapy to the cancer and sparing the patient.
So just a couple of things to elaborate or clarify what you just talked about. Of course, a lot of people have antibody drug conjugates in their mind after the ASCO plenary session when Kim Blackwell presented the T-DM1 data in HER2-positive breast cancer. What's the difference sort of chemically or how these agents work, and particularly in terms of the maytansine and the T-DM1 compared to the agent in B-vedotin?
Yeah, these drugs are not the first. The first one that was really studied widely was a conjugate of anti-CD33 and calicheamicin. And this was approved, and it's been since withdrawn from the market, for the treatment of AML because it had marginal activity and lots of toxicity. The goal here is to find an antibody that binds appropriately and can be internalized. And the linker has to be really tight so that the poison is not released into the system so you don't get excessive toxicity. And then I'm not sure how each company picks maytansine versus auristatin versus calicheamicin. Some of it is toxicity driven. Some of it is probably just the technology from that particular company. And I don't know that one is any better than the other between maytansine and auristatin. The calicheamicin is really relatively toxic compared to the others. So it conceptually binds to the tumor cell, is internalized, at which point this poison is released. If the poison is released into the system, it'd be life-threatening, potentially fatal.
So what about toxicity with this agent? It seems like with T-DM1, there's maybe some not too consequential thrombocytopenia. It seems like almost nothing else major. But with bevedotin, I've heard about neuropathy.
Right. With bevedotin, first of all, the good thing about it is the responses occur very quickly. We have patients that we've treated that the symptoms, the pruritus, the sweats, can disappear in a matter of days after treatment. But there are about 40 to 50% of patients who develop neuropathy. It's usually grade 1, grade 2. Of the grade 3s, most of those are reversible. It can be a motor, it can be a sensory neuropathy or combination of the two. So that's probably the biggest problem. There also is some myelosuppression that can occur with this drug as well. So you have to be careful with the drugs you're going to combine it with. For example, the anti-CD30, which in the old days was called SGN30, we did a study in CALGB, and we tried to combine it with our GVD regimen, which was gemcitabine, vinorelbine, and liposomal dox. And we got extraordinary life-threatening and fatal pulmonary toxicity. So now as you're moving this drug up in combination with this poison and you're trying to mix it with ABVD, you can't do it with the bleomycin because when they tried to do it with ABVD itself, again, they saw pulmonary toxicity.
That was just presented at the ASH meeting.
That was presented at the ASH meeting. So they got rid of the bleomycin. So now it's the A squared VD or ABVVD, however you like to call it. And the pulmonary toxicity is virtually gone. So you have to be careful, whether it be gemcitabine, bleomycin, and there's potentially other drugs which you might mix it with at some point, which could get you into a lot of trouble. So it's not just, here we have an antibody, let's throw it together with something and see what happens. You really have to plan ahead and think what you're doing.
You know, there's this concept out there of, you know, personalized oncology. I bet you've heard of that one.
I heard it somewhere, probably from you.
Yeah. Anyhow, you know, particularly marker-driven treatment and, you know, I don't know, an example, getting back to HER2, I'm not sure has panned out quite so much. I mean, it's being used in gastric HER2. But in terms of drugs like bevedotin, it kind of seems like if you have the CD30 antigen, it seems like it's something that might show some activity. So I guess my question is, where have we seen clinical activity of this agent? Where do we see CD30? I mean, you mentioned diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. Have patients been treated? Do we know whether they respond? And where are we heading in terms of, are we going to be driven more by markers than by histology?
Well, we're clearly going to be drawn more by not just markers, but pathways. And I'll talk about pathways in a minute, than histology. Because as you know, you look at 25 large cells or 25 classical Hodgkin's under the microscope, they may all look the same and they all behave differently. One patient's cured and one dies. And it's because of other things other than the histology. As I mentioned, not only is Hodgkin's exquisitely responsive to bevedotin, but anaplastic large cell lymphoma as well, which is an uncommon T-cell lymphoma, but one which expresses CD30. And whether it's the ALK positive or the ALK negative varieties of this lymphoma, they both respond comparably well to this drug with response rates in the mid-80%.
You mentioned T-cell lymphoma. What about specifically PTCL?
PTCL, about 20 to 30% of those are also CD30 positive, and studies will be focusing on that population of patients as well. Anything that's CD30 positive in a lymphoid malignancy is a targeted population, no pun intended, for this agent.
But we don't know right now, for example, whether PTCL, we have actual observed responses or treatment courses.
We, in PTCL, other than the anaplastic large cells, we really don't have data that I can give you that would say that X proportion of patients respond. The studies are just getting going.
I'm already thinking we could spend the entire time just talking about all this, but I do want to get into other stuff. But just a couple other questions, because it really is, I don't know, it seems sort of revolutionary. I hate to use that word. You mentioned ALCL. Where is bevedotin right now in non-protocol treatment, in your opinion, with this agent and disease? And what are the key trials out there?
Bevedotin is approved for patients who have relapsed or refractory to initial therapy. Initial therapy for at least the ALK-positive patients has been CHOP, and they tend to be very responsive. We're curing 60, 70, or even more percent of those patients. The ALK-negative patients don't fare nearly as well, whether that is a biological difference or an age difference, because the ALK-positive patients tend to be younger, the ALK-negatives tend to be older, and if you do it age by age, they seem to respond comparably. But again, just like we're trying to do with Hodgkin's, for the ALK-negatives at least, where maybe 40% of patients rather than 70 are being cured, it's something to be considered to try and incorporate it into frontline therapy. And CHOP brentuximab combinations are in development for those sorts of patients.
Any issues with neuropathy when you would think maybe with the, you know, vincristine?
Yeah, it's going to be CHIP, not CHOP.
Oh, what is that?
That's without the vincristine. The cyclophosphamide, doxorubicin, prednisone, drop the vincristine. Is not only for overlapping toxicity, but why do you need two drugs that both target microtubules?
Right. Okay, so that makes sense. And then just to finish out, again, in our breast cancer work, our listeners have been hearing cases from investigators of people who've gotten every possible chemo anti-HER agent, really in bad condition, get T-DM1, have prolonged, really meaningful clinical responses. Have you had patients like that in your practice who've gotten bevedotin for anything?
Oh, absolutely. We've had patients who have failed multiple prior regimens. I'm thinking of one woman in particular, and sent to us. We have patients sent to us all the time because I've run out of treatment, and they haven't even thought of bevedotin. There's one woman who had refractory disease to ABVD, and had failed a stem cell transplant, and what am I going to do next? She came to us with active disease. We gave her bevedotin. She's still in a complete remission about 6-7 months later and is on a wait list for an allo transplant. Unfortunately, when they went to look at her father, he had some heme malignancy in his bone marrow, and he was the best donor.
Wow. Any toxicity or neurotoxicity?
Had none. Absolutely none.
Wow.
And we have a lot of patients like this who come to us. I've run out of options. We give them this drug and they feel better almost immediately, within a few days. And we get them. It's a great bridge to transplant. But wouldn't it be great if we didn't have to wait that long? We could use it up front and cure more patients with less therapy.
We were talking about T-cell lymphoma, and even though there's not as many cases of that, still there's a lot going on in it. Any comments on the evolving role of HDAC inhibitors and pralatrexate?
Well, the management of patients with peripheral T-cell lymphomas has been challenging. The standard upfront regimen is CHOP, but it's really awful. The number of long-term disease-free survival patients is in the range of, 10, 15% or so. You could stretch it for 20 and select patients. So it's really not great, and everybody relapses. So we'd like to replace CHOP. At least I'd like to replace John. And we now have several drugs besides bevacizumab in the relapse setting, which have activity. We have romidepsin, which is an HDAC inhibitor, and we have pralatrexate, which is an antifol. Both of these drugs have response rates in the range of 25 to 30, 33, 4, 5%, depending on how you slice the data. Each has their own issues. The mucositis with pralatrexate, for the romidepsin, it's, you know, 4-hour infusions and other toxicities. It's nice that we have them. We clearly have patients who benefit from them. I don't know which one you should give first and which one you should give second. These patients tend to get one then the other because they're really sick. But we need combinations of things. There are other drugs with activity out there as well, lenalidomide, for example. And we're trying to combine that. And there's a new drug, an Aurora A kinase inhibitor, which Jonathan Friedberg presented some data at the ASH meeting. And in T-cell lymphomas, 5 out of 8 patients responded. Now, there is some GI toxicity and some mucositis, but I just treated a patient a couple of weeks ago with it who had god-awful peripheral T-cell lymphoma with huge cutaneous masses. And her symptoms and her masses kind of went away within a week of getting that drug. And she's coming back to see me next week and follow up. So we have these drugs. We need to know how to put them together rationally and then move them up front, try and replace CHOP. I know some people are adding these drugs to CHOP, but I think we're better off replacing anthracyclines. And in fact, in randomized trials, anthracyclines are not terribly active in T-cell lymphoma. So we need to replace that kind of a regimen with something that makes more sense.
Anyhow, I like the name Aurora kinase, but, you know, we'll see where things head with it. Let's shift over a little bit to the B-cell side, and I want to start out asking you about radioimmune therapy in FL, and particularly the paper or the study that you were part of that was first reported at ASH, and then I think it was updated or reported again at ASCO,
right,
looking at the incorporation of RIT into, I guess, was it, I'm not sure what the trial number was. Hold on. I'm sure you know it.
Yeah, it was a SWOG-led intergroup study, and Ollie Press was the principal investigator. And the results were initially presented at ASH. And the study design initially was CHOP rituximab, or CHOP followed by I-131 tocilizumab. We couldn't accrue to that study because in the interim, everybody found out that rituximab plus CHOP was so much better. So no one wanted to accrue to her CHOP-only arm. So that was jettisoned from the study, and it accrued very nicely after that point in time. And Ollie Press presented those data at ASH and showed that there was basically no difference between the CHOP-R and the CHOP radioimmunotherapy. Whether you looked at overall response rates, whether you looked at time-dependent endpoints, progression-free survival, that sort of stuff. And we asked the question of Ollie. I said, Ollie, what about if you slice and dice the patient populations by FLIPI score? Is there anything there? Is there anything that you can hold up and say, okay, these patients benefit from one versus the other? And that was the presentation at the ASCO meeting. And in fact, the answer is no. FLIPIs, blah, blah. The only thing that seemed to stand out was LDH and beta-2 microglobulin. And those sorts of, let's do a lot of analysis and we come up with LDH and beta-2 microglobulin is not satisfying to me. I want to see something more biological than that. And that work is going on. So it's really not clear what the role for radioimmunotherapy is in that context. As you know, it's approved. The other available one, the Y90 ibrutimumab tioxetan, is approved following induction therapy as a consolidation in follicular lymphoma. But I don't think there's been much penetrance as far as use in the community or even in academic centers of that approach.
Where are things heading with RIT? I'm not even sure I know where things are.
It is the most effective, least used therapy in follicular lymphoma. It's very active in appropriate patients, but people don't use it. And we could go on forever given the reasons, the expense, the complexity, the concern, is there life after radioimmunotherapy? Will patients respond to other things? The fact that patients have to be very highly selected based on blood counts, bone marrow involvement, prior radiation therapy, etc. The concerns, and which is real, of secondary malignancies such as MDS and AML, all those things are a part of the reason it's not being used. And I'll help you with a segue here. The other reason is that there are exciting new drugs out there which are simpler and very appealing and loads of clinical trials. So rather than the physician in the community having to send his patient off to someone else to get treated, there's now new drugs and he can participate in those trials and keep the patient. That's been one of the other big problems is, to be frank, loss of income. You have to send the patient to the radiation oncologist or the nuclear medicine guy to give RIT. So why not just keep the patient and give them either rituximab or something else? Or if you have access to one of the clinical trials with these novel agents, that's great too.
So can you describe a patient where you think, you know, you might actually utilize RIT outside a trial setting? And I'll say that I know myself that if we do surveys, and we have done surveys, and I pop in a number like 80-year-old with comorbidities, I see a lot of RIT being thought about in investigators, but not necessarily so much in practice.
Mm-hmm. The last patient I used it on was about 6 months ago. And this was a mid-60s-year-old guy who had failed R-CHOP for his follicular lymphoma and then went on a bendamustine trial and got a very good partial response, but he's the only patient reported who had life-threatening neurological toxicity, which took years to get better. But the response lasted for about 4 years. And when his disease came back, we weren't about to use that again. And he'd read about radioimmunotherapy. It's really simple. It's 8 days. You give a shot on day one, you give a shot on day eight, that's it. And you measure blood counts on a weekly basis. You don't even need all of the interim scans that you had to do in the past. The FDA has recently said, yeah, we agree with you. They don't add anything except expense and radiation. So it's really a simple therapy. I've had patients who have 5-year responses from this after failing a couple of lines of treatment. It's a good treatment, just people do not use it. And I know the company that owns it now would love to see more penetrance into the community. And I can't see how that is going to happen because of the new group of drugs out there that have really gotten everybody excited.
I just want you to follow up a little bit on a topic you kind of started to lead into, which is new agents in FL. I see that you've got another great review article on best practice in research clinical hematology of that name. So can you just sort of briefly talk about what some of the new pathways are, new agents are, and where you think they're going?
Well, this is really an exciting time. We have several drugs which target intracellular pathways. You know, for a long time, we've had the antibodies that affect the outside of the cell. We've had drugs like lenalidomide, which affect the microenvironment around the cell. Now we have drugs targeting the pathways. And then we have the B-cell receptor. When the B-cell receptor is activated, it triggers a number of downstream pathways. And we have drugs now that will inhibit certain portions of those pathways. The first one that caught our attention was fostamatinib disodium. And Jonathan Freeberg published some data a couple of years ago, and I wrote the editorial in Blood about that drug. And it was interesting across a broad spectrum of B-cell malignancies.
That's a SYK inhibitor?
That's the SYK inhibitor, correct. The SYK inhibitor, fostamatinib disodium, has activity in a broad range of B-cell malignancies. Unfortunately, the corporate decision was made not to pursue it anymore in lymphomas. But we now have other drugs. For example, we have a BTK inhibitor, Bruton's tyrosine kinase inhibitor, which initially was called PCI-32765, and now is called ibrutinib. And this is a fairly specific targeted agent for that pathway. And whether it be in non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, follicular, even large cell, and particularly in chronic lymphocytic leukemia, the response rates are very impressive. I won't give you numbers because the patient numbers are very small, But, you know, you're talking 30 to 50, 60%, depending on the histology. Mantle cell, 60, 75%. And these are pills. And these are pills with minimal toxicity. Other pathways, you've got the PI3 kinase
path. Can I just interrupt you? That's the first time I've heard a name. I've been hearing numbers and letters. What's the new name?
Ibrutinib.
Ibrutinib. I like that.
I-B-R-U-T-I-N-I, as in Bruton.
Yeah, I like it. Okay.
Now, some people call it ibrutinib, ibrutinib, tomato, tomato. It works.
Okay.
Another drug of considerable interest used to be called Cal-101, is now called GS-1101. This specifically targets the PI3 kinase pathway, particularly the delta isoform, which the company at least feels is the most important. And as with the previous drug I mentioned, has impressive activity in all these B-cell malignancies. And we also have drugs that target the mTOR pathway, mammalian target of rapamycin, such as everolimus, and target other pathways in the cells. So we're now developing studies to expand on their activity by combining them with other agents. For example, again, in CLGB/Alliance, we have a study that hopefully will be active soon in relapse follicular lymphoma of so-called R-squared plus GS-1101, R-squared being rituximab and lenalidomide, the other R being lenalidomide. And so we'll be doing a phase one of that in the very near future. And up front, we hope to be doing an R-squared plus ibrutinib, previously untreated patients, and then eventually compare them to R-squared alone and hopefully also to each other.
What about ibrutinib and GS-1101 together?
That would be a logical next step. In fact, there are some bispecific molecules out there that target PI3 kinase and mTOR that are of interest, but to combine those two drugs would be fascinating. Obviously, there are some difficulties because the companies are competitors, and highly so, but the NCI has CRADAs for both of those drugs, and it may at some point in time be possible. Because I think the way to do this, the lymphoma cell is pretty smart. It's eluded us forever. Follicular lymphoma is incurable. And why is that? Well, you block out one pathway, and it's got all these other pathways. It's got SYK, it's got BTK, it's got mTOR, it's got PI3K, on and on and on and on. You block one, the others are working just fine. And when they're activated, the cell just lives on gleefully and laughs at us. Says, you know, catch me if you can. If we could block several of these pathways, you know, the best thing would take an antibody, which, and the microenvironment, there's your R squared, and then block a couple of pathways in the cell. I think this is the way of the future with which we may eventually cure the incurable folliculars and mantle cell lymphomas.
What about other anti-CD20 agents, and specifically GA101, which we're now starting to see some data on?
Yeah, we have about 10 anti-CD20s lurking out there now, or used to be hanging out. Veltuzumab, GA101, ofatumumab. Each one has a little quirk to it to differentiate it from rituximab, whether it binds to a different epitope, then does rituximab, as in the case of ofatumumab, whether one's a type 1, one's a type 2, this, that, or the other thing. They want to be a little bit different, and this difference, they hope, will make it a better drug. And the only way you're going to show that it's a better drug is, A, if in a head-to-head it's more effective than rituximab, or B, if it works in patients who are rituximab refractory. We have an experience of the latter with ofatumumab. Tone Hagenbeek and his colleagues, Frank Morchhauser, et cetera, did a study in over 100 patients who were considered rituximab refractory, gave them ofatumumab, and the response rate was a blistering 11%. You know, didn't get anybody terribly excited with that. So that part was shot down. At the ASH meetings, a randomized trial was presented of rituximab versus GA101. And the response rate was a little bit higher with the GA101. The toxicity was a little bit higher with the GA101. But if you look at the progression-free survival curves, it was like the alpha helix. They just intertwined and there was no difference. So another problem with all these anti-CD20s is the fact that rituximab comes off patent in the next couple of years. And there's going to be biosimilars, there's going to be generic, and it's going to be very hard for practices to justify the price of what's going to be for a GA101 or one of those when generic rituximab may be half of that or less. So I don't know what the future is for all these other anti-CD20s. It's complicated.
Just continuing along the lines of new agents in FL, you mentioned the so-called R-squared regimen. And
right.
Any update on that and lenalidomide? And for that matter, you know, so much is going on with the IMIDs like lenalidomide and bortezomib and myeloma. It's just really amazing every time we do an education program in that area. But bortezomib also is another agent that's been looked at in FL. So what about these two agents in FL?
Well, let me dispense with bortezomib quickly. Most of us feel that it is no longer of interest based on a study presented by Bertrand Coiffier, I guess it was at ASH, where it was a randomized trial of the combination versus the single agent, where the addition of bortezomib to rituximab resulted in not much in the way of clinical benefit, but with considerable toxicity. There was a progression-free survival advantage, but it didn't meet the predetermined study endpoint. So basically what they wanted to get, they didn't get, even though there was some difference, so it was a negative trial. So we can dispense with that. As far as lenalidomide goes, lenalidomide is a fascinating drug and it's really ubiquitous now. And it is active against a broad range of lymphoid malignancies, particularly mantle cell lymphoma, where it's got about a 50% response rate. I have a patient who's now 4 years in remission, failing hyper-CVAD, failing stem cell transplant, failing R-CHOP, and he's in a 4-year remission from lenalidomide with his mantle cell. But it also has activity to a lesser degree in large cell, somewhere in the 25 to 35% range, or actually probably 20 to 35% range, depending on the paper you read. And follicular is around 25% also. But a lot of these drugs aren't great by themselves. It's what you combine them with that makes the difference. And I actually came up with the R-squared regimen years ago, 2008, as a CALGB study. It just took 2.5 years for the NCI to agree that it might actually be worth doing. In the meantime, one of my fellows, Nathan Fowler, left Georgetown, went to MD Anderson, did the study, and showed that in follicular lymphoma, untreated patients, the response rate was 90% or better. And we haven't seen a full publication of these data yet, but we've seen updates multiple times, and the data seem to hold up with additional numbers of patients.
Could I just ask, I think John Leonard presented some data on this combination at ASCO.
Right. John presented our clinical trial from the CALGB, which was in patients with rituximab relapsed but not refractory follicular lymphoma. And it started out as a 3-arm randomized trial of R, L versus the combination. And once again, no one would put any patients on the study because they didn't want R alone. So we dropped that arm. And so it ended up being a 2-arm trial of L versus what we now call R squared. And what we showed was that the overall response rate of 74 versus 50% and the CR rate of 30-something versus 13% strongly favored the combination. The progression-free survival looked also to favor the combination, but the follow-up duration was relatively short, and so we need longer follow-up. But this is, based on those data, it's now the platform for many of our new studies, as the ones I mentioned with GS1101, with ibrutinib, et cetera. Very interesting combination, and surprisingly, it may be an artifact or whatever, surprisingly, there were fewer cases of phlebitis and thromboembolism in the combined arm than in the lenalidomide alone arm. I don't understand why that should be, but that was a neat observation.
Well, that was actually what I was going to ask you about, which was the risk of thrombosis in this study. You know, obviously we know from myeloma, for example, prophylaxis is often used. What kind of prophylaxis was used? Are there any messages that came out in terms of thrombotic risk from that trial?
No, the risk was very low and we didn't use prophylaxis.
I thought it was like 16% in one of the arms.
That was the alone arm.
Oh, the alone arm. Okay.
But we're not prophylaxing these patients. And myeloma, as you know, it has a lot to do with the concurrent use of steroids, et cetera. You know, if you're worried about it, you take an aspirin, and that reduces the risk to about 1% or 2%.
We get questions about the issue of tumor lysis syndrome in CLL, and I know that's come up with the lenalidomide. What do we know overall about this risk with, you know, all agents?
Yeah, I published a paper long time ago in JCO looking at fludarabine, cladribine, and pentostatin, which were the three big drugs at the time. And the risk was really low. It was only about 0.5%. But the more effective your therapies, the more likely you are going to encounter tumor lysis syndrome. It is of particular concern with lenalidomide because it's very idiosyncratic. It doesn't appear to be dose-related. It occurs in maybe 10% of patients, but it's not dose-related. In fact, there have been life-threatening and even fatal cases at 5 milligrams a day. And as you get higher in the doses, it doesn't appear to make any difference. We don't know which patients are most likely to develop it. It doesn't seem to correlate with much of anything, but it does occur, and you have to be careful with it. It may be better if you're combining it with rituximab to give the rituximab first before you get the lenalidomide. There are some kind of soft data suggesting that order of things may reduce the risk. But it's really an interesting drug in CLL, and we've seen some nice responses. But not only tumor lysis, the tumor flare reaction is also something that clinicians need to be aware of. A week or two after you give the first dose of lenalidomide, you may think the patient is rapidly progressing. The lymphocyte count goes up, the LDH goes up, the lymph nodes get big, they get painful, and by the time you refer to the patient to the ENT surgeon to biopsy a node to see if he's transformed, the nodes have gone down again. And this tumor flare is an interesting phenomenon, and some say that it actually predicts for a more favorable outcome. But that leads me to another fascinating observation with the other drugs we were talking about before, the GS1101, the BTK inhibitors, the mTOR inhibitors, et cetera. They are also associated with an unusual finding in that when you start these drugs, in patients with CLL, the lymphocyte count may go through the roof, may go over 100,000 or even higher, which is a demargination phenomenon and not evidence of progressive disease. So in a patient who's getting one of these drugs and the lymphocyte count goes up, instead of going, oh darn, you know, they're not responding, but wait a minute, the nodes are shrinking, the spleen is shrinking, the crit's getting better, the platelets are getting better, and so what? The lymphocyte count's going up. That has been called a nodal response by the companies, but we've actually got a paper in press in JCO now, which basically says, ignore the lymphocyte count when you're using such drugs as a measure of progressive disease unless something else is also getting worse.
Just two more things I was going to ask you about. One is, again, in a patient with CLL whom for whatever reason you might be more suspicious than usual based on the situation, the agent, whatever, that this might happen. A patient who may be older, comorbidities where you really don't want to see it happen. What's the most aggressive you'll be about monitoring it and treating it?
Well, I just saw a patient last week who had, we put him on a CLGB study, but he had rapidly advancing CLL, the growing spleen, a white count that had tripled in the last few months. So we gave him a single dose of rasburicase as an outpatient prior to treating him. Whether that helped or not, he didn't go into tumor lysis. You can do that. Allopurinol can work to prevent it with hydration. You know, you're concerned about patients who, prior to the treatment, have not only extensive tumor bulk, but have maybe mildly to moderately abnormal renal function, may have a high uric acid to begin with, or abnormalities of calcium, potassium, and phosphorus, which may suggest that they already are predisposed to this. It's those kind of patients that are high risk, and should get either allopurinol or, if you're really concerned, a single dose of raspiricase a few hours before they're treated is generally sufficient to prevent the development of what can be a life-threatening or even fatal complication of treatment.
Have you observed any side effects or toxicity with raspiricase?
We've used raspiricase quite a number of times, and I haven't seen any toxicity from that drug whatsoever.
Okay, so final question is about the Rummel presentation of the STILL study, plenary presentation at ASCO. What about it was new? What's the background of it? What do you think it means?
The presentation at ASCO by Matthias Rummel was an update of the randomized STILL trial of R-CHOP versus R-bendamustine. Bendamustine is a drug that's been around since the 60s, even the 50s, in East Germany. In fact, the 50th anniversary meeting for that drug is going to be held in Jena in September. Jena is the town in Germany where the factory was. And based on some data from Germany of single-agent activity, Rummel combined bendamustine with rituximab in relapsed and refractory patients and got an impressive response rate of 90% or so. And we did a similar study, and we published that in JCO, and we essentially confirmed his data. He then took a very courageous step and compared in the upfront setting R-CHOP with R-bendamustine in a study that was intended to be a non-inferiority trial. And what he showed was that the response rates between the two regimens were the same. They were 90-92%. But the complete remission rate with R-Benda was around 40% versus 30% with the R-CHOP, which was significant. And the primary endpoint of progression-free survival was also significantly longer with the RB than the R-CHOP. Looking at the toxicity profile, R-CHOP was associated with more cytopenias, more infections, more neuropathy, more stomatitis. Bendamustine was associated with more rash. R-CHOP gives you alopecia. R-Benda doesn't give you alopecia. So overall, it was more effective and less toxic. The presentation at ASCO actually didn't provide much of an update compared to their 2009 presentation, other than a little longer follow-up, showing that the differences in progression-free survival held up, and in fact, it may be a little wider, but there was no survival benefit to the R-Benda combination at this point in time. So it was merely an update of data. We sure would like to see a publication. This is the third abstract, but we haven't seen a published paper of this regimen, and hopefully one will appear in the near future.
What do you think this means, or what did it mean in 2009 in terms of non-protocol treatment? And, you know, people talk a lot about younger patients.
Well, there was no difference if you slice the patients by age, by FLIPI, by LDH, by any other thing you can look at. The RB was better. Now, what you have to understand is this was a pool of patients. It was follicular. It was mantle cell. It was marginal zone, lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma, small lymphocytic lymphoma, all thrown together, and you're seeing curves for all those different diseases in one curve. So if you separate them out, almost all of the groups benefited except for the marginal zone. How this has impacted on things, even in the absence of a publication, is that the penetrance, and this is your forte, the penetrance of R-Benda in the community now is up around 65%. And this is in striking contrast to what we would have seen in 2009, where it was probably, you know, I don't know, 10, 20, 30%. So these data have really, really changed how many clinicians in academia and in the community treat patients with follicular lymphoma.
And we definitely have seen this in our surveys over the last few years. But the other thing that I observe is the increasing incorporation of the BR regimen into new trials.
BR has actually become the backbone now, or at least B is the backbone, of many of the new drug regimens. And I refer to this as Chesson's rule of new drug development. The activity of a drug is directly proportional to its negative impact on clinical research, which means that you get a new drug, whether it's rituximab, whether it's bendamustine or bevacizumab, it's used in the relapse setting. It's so exciting that it's rapidly moved up front. You have no data with any drugs in patients refractory to those agents. Their activity is so high, it's hard to beat them. So what has to be done is you got to join them. So now everything is bendamustine plus or minus GA101, GS1101, ibrutinib, et cetera, because you're not going to try and beat a drug like that head on. And it's probably going to be tough to get a response in patients who are refractory to bevacizumab, bendamustine, et cetera. So it is now a major platform, but the platform for the future is going to be R squared. And that's really a stepping up in patients with CLL and with indolent lymphoid malignancies.
So I didn't quite get that, though. You said it's proportional to the negative impact in clinical trials?
Yeah.
What do you mean?
The more active a drug is, the more rapidly, the harder it is to beat it, so it makes it harder for another drug to get on the market. It's rapidly moved up front, so there are no longer rituximab naive, BV naive, bendamustine naive patients. So in the relapse setting, what are you going to compare it against? You've run out of comparators other than old stuff. And as a result, you've got to combine new drugs with it. In a patient who fails BR, we have no data on what works. In patients who fail bevacizumab, we have no idea if anything else is going to work in those patients. And it's a real challenge to have a drug that gets you an 80% response rate to try and beat it in a comparative trial, or to say, I'm going to be just fine in patients refractory to that kind of drug.
Just out of curiosity, though, because it is a practical issue, you know, when a patient does have progressive disease after BR, for example, with FL, what are some of the agents or strategies you use that you've seen to be effective?
I think that we're in trouble at that point. That's sort of what I'm saying. It used to be you had R-CHOP, and then you could get bendamustine, and then maybe something else.
So R-CHOP doesn't
work? We don't know whether R-CHOP works in bendamustine refractory patients. We know the converse, that if you're R-CHOP refractory, BR will work, but we don't know the converse. It hasn't been looked at. So what we do is things like radioimmunotherapy once in a while, but we mostly do is put patients on clinical trials with the drug antibody conjugates. We occasionally will use lenalidomide off study. We have new monoclonal antibodies. And now, fortunately, we're going to have the BTK inhibitors, the PI3 kinase inhibitors, et cetera, which I think are going to really change how we approach lymphoid malignancies.